terrified of being outflanked on their right wing by the Tea Party caucus, for whom TARP and the bailouts were anathema. With the Republicans demanding swinging cuts and privatization of Medicare, no deal could be reached, and on October 1, 2013, at 12:01 a.m. Eastern Time, the government went into partial shutdown, with up to 850,000 federal employees put on temporary, unpaid leave. The White House was forced to suspend the president's foreign travel. At a meeting of APEC in Indonesia, the American president would not make his rendezvous with his Chinese counterpart. It was not until October 16th, hours before the Treasury's final deadline, that the Senate passed a continuing resolution to fund the government through February 2014. A temporary expedient with which the Republican leadership fell into line once they realized the political damage they were suffering from the standoff. Though a disaster was avoided, it is important not to normalize what had happened. The radical right wing of the Republican Party, xenophobic nationalists, many of them evangelical zealots, motivated by a worldview fashioned by the alt-right, or Pat Buchanan's extreme America First nationalism, a group whose hardcore accounted for 10% of the House of Representatives, had threatened to paralyze the most important nation-state in the global system. As Steve Bannon, the editor of the Breitbart news site, a cheerleader of the Tea Party and a rising star of the alt-right, gushed to a Daily Beast journalist in November 2013, "I'm a Leninist. Lenin wanted to destroy the state, and that's my goal too. I want to bring everything crashing down and destroy all of today's establishment." For the likes of Bannon, the crisis of 2008 and the bailout had marked a fundamental caesura in American history. The morning of September 18, 2008, when Bernanke and Paulson's alarmism had scared President Bush into approving the TARP plan, was a fundamental turning point. It was a moment, according to Bannon, at which the threat of systemic collapse revealed the true power structure. "We are upside down. The industrial democracies today have a problem we have never had before. We are over-leveraged, and we have built a welfare state which is completely and totally unsupportable." Only a no-holds-barred struggle against the liberal elite and the state they had constructed in their image could save America. If this discomforted the failed Republican establishment as well, all the better. To challenge the power structure, Robert Reich had called for a new progressive age, a new civil rights movement, a movement unafraid to question the status quo at all levels. That challenge had arrived. But it came from the right, not the left. The world was aghast. In Japan, Newsweek appeared on newsstands declaring, "Ruined America, a superpower destroys itself." The Wall Street Journal reported on shutdown Freude spreading across Europe, as for once it was America, not the Eurozone, that was in the dock of global public opinion. Der Spiegel commented bleakly, "The United States had embarrassed itself on the global stage. Is this how a superpower behaves?" One might respond that only a superpower could possibly afford to behave like this. But how long would the United States be able to uphold that position if it was internally so at odds that it was unable to decide whether to honor its debts or pay its soldiers? Predictably, Xinhua, China's official news agency, took a dim view. Editorialist Liu Chang wrote, "As U.S. politicians of both political parties are still shuffling back and forth between the White House and the Capitol Hill without striking a viable deal to bring normality to the body politic they brag about, it is perhaps a good time for the befuddled world to start considering building a de-Americanized world." On a lighter note, a Canadian comic living in China commented, "Chinese must be wondering, when will America embrace real reform? How long can this system survive? Where is America's Gorbachev?" Nor was it only foreigners who were worried. If the Tea Party would turn the Republican Party into a vehicle for an attack on the creditworthiness of U.S. government, what was safe? So far, the Tea Party had made Obamacare its main target. What would be next? By 2014, the Republican right would block immigration reform and refuse to fund the Export-Import Bank, both priorities of American business. At the G20, the Americans were embarrassed to report that funding for the IMF was being held hostage by Republican opponents of abortion, who wanted contraception excluded from Obamacare. What if the Republican zealots targeted Fed independence or trade policy next? Of course, there were business interests aligned with the Tea Party on tax and welfare issues. The coal lobby wanted environmental regulation stripped away. A clique of right-wing oligarchs saw the movement as the vehicle for a cultural and socio-economic counter-revolution. But with the 2013 budget fight, the mainstream of the American business leadership could no longer ignore the problem. Over the winter of 2013 to 2014, the Chamber of Commerce mobilized not to fight organized labor, but to resist the Republican insurgency. "No fools on our ticket," was the Chamber's slogan for the 2014 midterms, a euphemism for excluding the Tea Party. A spokesman for the Chamber put it this way: "The crowd that wants to come to Washington and blow the place up and shut the place down, that's a threshold issue for us. We care about governing." By 2014, the signs of realignment were undeniable. While the Tea Party inveigled against special interests that had come to dominate our political culture, self-serving politicians, and the interfering strong hand of a powerful elite, it was Democratic candidates who advertised themselves as business-friendly. As Senator Chuck Schumer of New York put it, "Democrats and business are on the same side on a range of issues." The Tea Party has dragged the Republican Party so far to the right that business is now closer to mainstream Democrats than Republicans. The alignment that had first become clear during the bank bailout of 2008 was becoming something more entrenched. In the name of nationalism and the American dream, the right wing claimed the cause of systemic change, while the Democratic Party establishment filled the middle ground the Republicans vacated. The question of the comprehensive progressive campaign to fight for greater equality was left begging. Chapter 20. Taper Tantrum. That the astonishing events in Congress in 2013 did not lead to an immediate crisis in the bond market pointed to the resilience of the U.S. Treasuries as the global safe asset of choice. Though the Chinese and Germans might complain, and the market blipped, demand for U.S. Treasuries quickly recovered. Ultimately, the market for IOUs drawn on the American taxpayer was underwritten by the Fed. Unlike the ECB, America's central bank left no doubt that it backed its government's debt. QE3 bond purchases provided immediate support, keeping prices up and rates down. This provided at least one point of stability for global investors. But after the events of 2013, questions could no longer be avoided. Was one of the unintended side effects of the stability generated by the Fed to free politics from market constraints and thus enable Republican extremism? Did America's ability to ride out short-term budget crises like those of 2011 and 2013 lead contemporaries to underestimate the future dangers that the degeneration of American democracy might bring with it? And how long would the Fed's technocratic interventions compensate for America's lackluster economic recovery and the shambles in the legislative branch? How long could the Fed continue with QE3? When would the Fed begin tapering? Compared with the chaos in fiscal policy, these were, on the face of it, normal monetary policy questions, except that since 2008, there was no longer any such thing as normal monetary policy. The enormous expansion of the Fed balance sheet underpinned not just the U.S. banking system, but the entire global dollar system. Furthermore, the Fed had not just expanded its balance sheet, it had changed its composition. Buying up long-term securities in exchange for cash reserves, the Fed had absorbed onto its books the maturity mismatch that had undone the shadow banking system. After successive phases of QE, it was the Fed that held long-term securities that were matched against short-term liabilities, such as cash and deposits by American and European banks. Despite some nail-biting by inflation hawks, this posed no immediate stability risk. The banks were happy to hold their cash reserves with the Fed. If interest rates went up, the Fed, as one of the largest holders of bonds, would suffer a capital loss. But this was more than made up for by the $350 billion in profits that the Fed paid to the Treasury between 2008 and 2013. The real question was the likely fallout in the financial markets and money markets when the Fed changed its stance. Any move to moderate the Fed's bond purchases, let alone to unwind its position, implied a comprehensive adjustment in the willingness of the markets to absorb not only a greater volume of bonds, but also some of the maturity mismatch that the Fed was carrying. And that would have to happen at the same time as short-term interest rates were nudging up. If, on the other hand, the Fed continued QE3, its balance sheet would further inflate, bond prices would remain elevated, interest rates would remain stuck near zero, and imbalances would further accumulate. In 2008, the Fed had embarked on a vertiginous tightrope walk from which there was no way back to the certainties of the Great Moderation. Both at home and abroad, the Fed's low interest rate policy created a superheated investment climate. By its bond purchasing program, which pushed up bond prices and depressed yields, the Fed incentivized investors to shift out of bonds and to place their funds in higher risk, higher return assets. How far this impulse actually went to explain the stock market boom is debatable. The econometric evidence is strongest for the impact of QE1 in launching the first phase of the stock market recovery in 2009. But for the average Wall Street booster, the visual association between the Fed's balance sheet and the surging value of the S&P 500 was plenty to be going along with. As a strategist for Citigroup told the Financial Times, everything revolves around monetary policy. It's not the underlying economics that's driving things, it's central bank liquidity. In 2008, the Fed had intervened to stop the market from imploding. It had pumped trillions into the financial system. Now the markets hung on its every word. Investors looked for higher yields, not just in U.S. equities, but further afield. Dollars were cheap for everyone. Any investor who was willing to take a gamble on exchange rate movements could borrow cheaply in dollars and invest in high-yielding emerging markets. Assuming the dollar did not sharply appreciate before the debt was due, it would be a profitable carry trade. By the middle of 2015, governments and businesses outside America would pile up $9.8 trillion of debts denominated in dollars. Much of this went to rich, developed world economies. But $3.3 trillion was owed by emerging market borrowers, both government and private. From the point of view of the yield-chasing investor, the more exotic the securities, the better. In September 2012, Zambia issued its first dollar-denominated bond. With a modest 5.6% coupon, a $750 million offering attracted more than $11 billion in bids. A year later, a state-backed tuna fishing venture in Mozambique raised $850 million. Altogether, African sovereign borrowers garnered $17 billion in bond funding in 2012 to 2013. In May 2013, the boom reached its peak, with the $11 billion 10-year bond issued by Petrobras, Brazil's state-owned oil company. It was the largest bond issue ever by an emerging market corporation. Demand was so great that the yield on the Petrobras issue fell to as little as 4.35%, less than many sovereign borrowers. This global interest in emerging market debt was exciting from the point of view of the borrowers, but it also exposed them to serious risks. Huge, aggressively managed funds crowded into tight markets. As the IMF pointed out, given that the largest 500 asset management companies had more than $70 trillion in their portfolios, a 1% reallocation implied a flow in or out of an asset class of $700 billion. This was enough either to swamp or to starve the emerging markets. The withdrawal of funds that had caused such stress in 2008 around the periphery of the world economy had amounted to only $246 billion. The unprecedented inflow that transformed the outlook of those same economies in 2012 was $368 billion. This disproportion created risk for the borrowers. But it was potentially bad news for the investors as well, If there was to be a sudden wave of withdrawals, the small size of emerging financial markets would amplify the stampede effect. If the Fed reversed its policy and money flooded back to the United States, who would be the first to sell? Who would get out without fatal losses? According to BIS data, professionally managed funds increased their stake in emerging market equity and bonds from $900 billion to $1.4 trillion between 2008 and 2014. Set against global totals running into the tens of trillions, those were not huge numbers. But they were comparable to the stock of toxic subprime assets, which had caused such havoc in 2007 to 2008, and to the debts of Greece, Spain, and Ireland, which had destabilized the eurozone in 2010 to 2012. After subprime and after eurozone sovereign debt, were emerging markets to be the next volume in the trilogy of debt crises? Not for nothing, the financial officials of booming emerging markets like Brazil complained about the influx of hot money from the United States. At the G20 in Seoul, in November 2010, they had lambasted Bernanke for adopting QE2, dropping US interest rates, and allowing the dollar to slide. By 2013, many emerging markets had gone beyond the war of words to adopt capital controls. Brazil, South Korea, Thailand, Indonesia all took steps to slow the inflow of funds and curb the appreciation of their currencies. 15 years earlier, in the heyday of the Washington Consensus, this would have put them beyond the pale. Restraining international capital movement was a retreat from the most fundamental liberalizing policy of the 1970s and 1980s. But the advocates of the market revolution had foreseen neither the emerging market crises of the 1990s nor monetary policy on the scale of QE. Faced with a giant flux of the global credit cycle, amplified by spillover effects from the Fed's crisis fighting, controls on capital inflows were grudgingly accepted as a pragmatic necessity, even by the IMF. It was, The Economist magazine commented, as if the Vatican had given its blessing to birth control. As far as the markets were concerned, everything depended on when and how the Fed changed course. Back in September 2012, Bernanke had made the giant bond-buying program of QE3 that was soaking the world in dollar liquidity conditional on America's labor market. He had promised that interest rates would stay at rock bottom until unemployment fell below 6.5%. In the spring of 2013, with the U.S. economy beginning to edge toward that threshold, the Fed began to drop hints. The moment was approaching at which it would consider slowing the pace of asset purchases. It was a delicate game. The Fed didn't want to taper too abruptly. The labor market was not yet fully recovered. The sluggish recovery that was troubling Larry Summers might not withstand a sudden spike in interest rates. For the investors, on the other hand, it was crucial to be ahead of the game. If they knew that the Fed was going to raise rates in the foreseeable future and that bond prices would fall, they wanted to be the first to sell. Of course, no one could know for sure whether the Fed would indeed begin to taper, or precisely when. So another reason to sell was to test the Fed's resolve. As Richard Fisher, chair of the Dallas Fed and himself a former hedge fund manager, put it to the Financial Times, in characteristically colourful terms, "Markets tend to test things. We haven't forgotten what happened to the Bank of England when George Soros broke the pound's peg in the ESM in September 1992. I don't think anyone can break the Fed, but I do believe that big money does organize itself somewhat like feral hogs. If they detect a weakness or a bad scent, they'll go after it." For Fisher, given this tendency to herding, it made sense for the Fed to socialize the idea that quantitative easing is not a one-way street. But given the likely impact on the fragile recovery of a large step up in interest rates, Fisher did not expect Bernanke to go from wild turkey to cold turkey overnight. The feral hogs should beware of getting ahead of themselves. On May 22, 2013, Bernanke took the plunge. He told Congress, "If we see continued improvement, and we have confidence that that is going to be sustained, then in the next few meetings, we could take a step down in our pace of purchases." The markets skipped a beat. Then, at 2:15 p.m. on June 19, 2013, Bernanke made a more specific announcement. Conditional on continued positive economic data, the FOMC would vote on scaling back its monthly bond purchases from $85 billion to $65 billion at the upcoming September 2013 policy meeting. The bond buying program might wrap up entirely by mid-2014. Despite weeks of preparation, Bernanke's statement triggered a full-scale taper tantrum. In a matter of seconds, yields surged from 2.17 to 2.3%. 2 days later, they had risen to 2.55% and would peak at 2.66%. These were small changes in absolute terms, but amounted to an increase in interest costs of almost 25% and inflicted a correspondingly serious capital loss on bondholders. U.S. equity markets reacted in sympathy, losing 4.3% in a matter of days. In the emerging markets, Bernanke's May announcement had already been enough to provoke a violent reaction. If the Fed reduced its purchases, bond prices began to ease and yields nudged upward, the emerging markets would come under a double pressure. Not only would their rates have to adjust by at least the same amount as the United States, but they would face an amplification effect through the exchange rate. As The Economist explained, a stock of dollar debt is like a short position, that is, a speculative position, assuming that the dollar exchange rate will either remain level or fall. A Fed interest rate increase signaled not only higher borrowing costs, but a likely upward movement in the dollar. Exposed emerging market borrowers would run to cover their dollar exposure, amplifying the currency adjustment and increasing the pressure on other dollar borrowers. Already in the spring of 2013, as markets began to worry about Bernanke's next move, the emerging markets felt the pressure. For the emerging markets, the funding boom was over. The exchange rates of what Morgan Stanley dubbed the Fragile Five, Turkey, Brazil, India, South Africa, and Indonesia, declined precipitously. Western investors pooled their money. Interest rates went up to counter the vacuum cleaner effect of Fed policy. Capital controls put in place to curb excessive inflows did not prevent foreign money from leaving, but they limited the scale of the damage. As one Brazilian central banker remarked, "We knew this was going to come, and we prepared ourselves." Stern American observers noted that the global credit cycle was not fate. Countries that had allowed their currencies to appreciate had been subject to smaller inflow of funds. Nor, when the global credit cycle reversed, did everyone lose funding at the same pace. Among the emerging markets, the hardest hit were those with less than fully sound financial positions. The Fed tightening was going to be tough for everyone, but if they did not put their budgets in order, they had only themselves to blame. That made sense as a moral message, and it conveniently deflected responsibility from the United States. It was up to the emerging markets to look after themselves. But it did not turn out to be well supported by the evidence. The biggest losers among the emerging markets, in fact, tended to be those that had attracted the largest foreign inflows, which also tended to be those with the most solid financial records. In any case, home truths about fiscal discipline came late for those now facing a funding squeeze. Some buckled down. Raghuram Rajan, the one-time critic of financial market euphoria and former chief economist of the IMF, now earned his spurs as India's central bank governor by raising rates and stabilizing the rupee. But the taper tantrum was a test of political as well as financial resilience. Not all governments responded with equanimity to such abrupt external pressure. When QE taper talk hit the Turkish currency in May 2013, President Erdogan was struggling with a dramatic domestic challenge as protesters clashed with riot police in Istanbul's Gezi Park. Erdogan had no doubt about how to interpret this coincidence. It was no coincidence at all. The internal political and external financial pressures on his government were part of a conspiracy by unspecified foreign forces, bankers, and international and local media outlets to push for regime change. For Erdogan, the pressure was being applied to all the countries that dared to claim a new place for themselves on the world stage, countries like Brazil and Turkey. The symbols are the same. The posters are the same. Twitter, Facebook are the same. The international media is the same. They are being led from the same center, the same game, the same trap, the same aim. The masters of social media in Silicon Valley, the crusading liberals at the State Department and the Fed were all in on it. In an inflammatory speech, he denounced the connections between Turkish private banks, international capital groups, and, according to at least one report, Israel. "Who won from these three-week-long demonstrations?" President Erdogan asked. "The interest lobby won. The enemies of Turkey won." Foreign experts might insist that Turkey had simply to put its economic house in order, but Erdogan had other ideas. Frustrated with the EU's failure to proceed with Turkish accession negotiations and the Obama administration's failure to act in Syria, he lurched toward Moscow. Turkey, Ankara let it be known, would welcome membership in the Economic Cooperation Organization founded by Russia and China in Shanghai. Compared with the capricious West, the Russia-China axis seemed to promise stability. At the G20 in St. Petersburg on September 5th and 6th, 2013, as the world waited to see how the Fed's Open Market Committee would vote, the tone was more measured than that from Ankara, but the message was loud and clear. The Fed needed to acknowledge that everyone, including the United States, was living in an interdependent world. The finance ministers of both Brazil and Indonesia demanded more clarity from Bernanke. China, which was exposed to the United States not just through trade, but also through its giant dollar bond holding, was no less vociferous. As one official spokesman put it, "Given that U.S. monetary policy has a huge influence on emerging markets and the global economy, we hope that U.S. monetary policy authorities, whether exiting or scaling down stimulus, will not only consider the U.S.'s own economic needs, but also think about economic circumstances in emerging markets." Rajan was the emerging market spokesman with the highest personal profile in the United States. During the crisis of 2008, he reminded America, the emerging markets had undertaken huge fiscal and monetary stimulus in support of global growth. The industrialized countries could not now wash their hands and say, "We'll do what we need to, and you do the adjustment." We need better cooperation, and unfortunately, that has not been forthcoming so far. Interdependence was one of the nostrums of the age of globalization, and it was all very well to call for greater cooperation. But why should the Fed listen to such demands? In 2008, it had provided liquidity to the entire world economy. Now it was doing its best to sustain the revival. But its mandate was national. It was responsible for the American economy, not the wider world. As far as the Fed was concerned, the really compelling argument was that of blowback. This was what had clinched the case for the massive swap line action in 2008, and this was the point made in the fall of 2013 by IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde. The reverberations from the Fed's huge monetary shocks, she warned Washington, may well feed back to where they began, that is, back on the United States. But it was one thing for the Fed to acknowledge that Europe's megabanks might bring the house down. It was quite another to make the same claim for the emerging markets. Looking at the numbers, no one could seriously argue that the business cycles of Indonesia or India had much impact on U.S. financial stability. The interdependence of the global age was all-pervasive, but it was emphatically not symmetrical. Some received shocks, others dealt them out. In any case, given that Republican insurgents were in the process of shutting down the federal government and were eyeing the IMF's budget as a potential hostage, it would have been politically disastrous for the Fed to acknowledge that it was conditioning its latest policy move on business conditions in Indonesia. Instead, the protests from the emerging markets provided a convenient occasion for the Fed to make a stout show of American patriotism. As Dennis Lockhart, president of the Atlanta Fed, reassured Bloomberg TV in August 2013, "You have to remember that we are a legal creature of Congress, and that we only have a mandate to concern ourselves with the interest of the United States. Other countries simply have to take that as a reality and adjust to us if that's something important for their economies. James Bullard of the St. Louis Fed emphasized the same point. We're not going to make policy based on emerging market volatility alone. Then, on September 18th, came the Fed's long-awaited decision. After the build-up since May, the FOMC announced that it would leave interest rates where they were and continue bond buying at the current rate, pending more evidence that progress will be sustained. The taper, the prospect of which had been giving the markets jitters since May, was off. The decision to change nothing unleashed a frenzy of interpretation not about the likelihood of tapering, but about why it had not happened. Were the doves on the Fed board resisting an interest rate shock? Had Bernanke got cold feet? Was he kicking the can down the road for his successor to deal with? Or was the Fed consistent in its policy, but bad at forecasting? Between the spring of 2013, when it began to think about tapering, and September, when it decided to postpone it, the Fed had adjusted its forecast for economic growth sharply downward. If the economy was recovering less strongly than expected, this would rescue the Fed's reputation as a consistent policymaker, but at the price of undermining confidence in its forecasts and highlighting the downturn in expectations. Or was the Fed neither cowardly nor a bad forecaster? Was it playing a subtle, tactical game? If it was committed to ensuring that the U.S. economy completed its slow recovery without interruption from a premature and violent increase in rates, it needed to know how severely bond markets would react to a reduction in monetary stimulus. The evidence of the taper tantrum in June 2013 was clear. The markets were impatient. Investors would rapidly tighten credit conditions on any hint of movement by the Fed. If the Fed believed that what was necessary was something more gradual, then after the initial tapering announcements in May and June, it needed to shock markets a third time in the opposite direction, letting them know that though tapering was coming, it was not a one-way bet. Four different interpretations: Fed politics, Fed weakness, Fed forecasting error, Fed game-playing. Which was it? How were markets to know, and without knowing, how were they to react? Given the Fed's hesitancy, one might have expected the bond vigilantes to take up the fight. There was profound hostility to Bernanke among the more militant investor crowd. In October 2013, Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, the largest asset manager, accused the Fed of feeding bubble-like market conditions. His chief investment officer for fixed income complained that there were tremendous distortions building in interest rates. But there was no unanimity in the market. Bill Gross at Allianz PIMCO argued that investors should accept the inevitable. If the aim of the Fed was to engineer a gradual exit from the gigantic debt bubble of the boom years, what Ray Dalio at the Bridgewater hedge fund called beautiful deleveraging, bond investors would have to accept that this came at their expense. They should abandon their expectation of an imminent increase in rates. Right now, the market and the Fed forecasts expects Fed funds to be 1% higher by late 2015 and 1% higher still by December 2016. Bet against that. In betting on a lower policy rate than now priced into markets, a bond investor should expect a certain pastoral quietude in future years, much like that grazing cow, I suppose, not that exciting, but what the hay, it's an existence. Mother Nature, nor Mother Market, cares not a whit for your losses, nor your hoped-for double-digit return from an equity bond portfolio that is priced for much less. Be a contented cow, not a voracious crow, and graze wisely with increasing certainty that the Fed and its forward guidance is your best bet for survival. With trillions of dollars at stake, and markets feverishly trying to second-guess the Fed's policy, was Bill Gross's pastoral image not wishful thinking? Rather than a herd grazing contentedly to the Financial Times, it seemed that relations between the markets and the Fed were increasingly coming to resemble the contorted psychodrama of a rocky marriage. Investors might take Gross's advice and practice believing that central banks love me. but the refrain hid deep tensions and uncertainties. For the past 5 years, under the influence of massive Fed stimulus, investor strategies had come to resemble one another, leaving them to second-guess themselves, one another, and the central bank. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? What have we done to each other? What will we do? A refrain equally applicable to a concerned policymaker as a nervous husband. The whole thing reeks of a marriage built on shaky foundations. At any given moment, the balance might be upset by a shift in policy or a market mood swing. The consequences for the entire global economy would be deeply unpredictable. "I will practice believing that the Fed loves me" was also the prescription that foreign central bankers would have to follow. The decision not to halt QE3 eased pressure on emerging markets. India's rupee, which had been hardest hit by the taper tantrum, rebounded from 68 to the dollar to 61.9 to the dollar in early October. Indonesia's currency stopped its precipitous slide. This was a relief, but Rajan and his colleagues would have to believe that the Fed bore them in mind, despite the fact that Congress jealously watched over the Fed's exclusively American mandate, and despite the fact that the Fed had made its decision while ostentatiously flaunting its indifference to the rest of the world. All the more significant was what the Fed did behind the scenes. On October 31, 2013, in the weeks following the September taper pullback and the congressional budget standoff, the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the Bank of Canada, and the Swiss National Bank made a low-key joint announcement. Their existing temporary bilateral liquidity swap arrangements are being converted to standing arrangements, that is, arrangements that will remain in place until further notice. The standing arrangements will constitute a network of bilateral swap lines among the 6 central banks. These arrangements allow for the provision of liquidity in each jurisdiction in any of the 5 currencies foreign to that jurisdiction, should the 2 central banks in a particular bilateral swap arrangement judge that market conditions warrant such action in one of their currencies. The existing temporary swap arrangements have helped to ease strains in financial markets and mitigate their effects on economic conditions. The standing arrangements will continue to serve as a prudent liquidity backstop. The swap lines that have been so crucial to stabilizing global financial markets, and which had been uncapped in October 2008, were now being established on a permanent basis. As in 2008, this network had limits. None of the most fragile emerging markets were included in the inner core of the Fed's swap network. But they were not left out in the cold, either. What began to take shape were regional sub-networks. These were uneven. There was nothing of note around the core European central banks. But in Asia, the central banks were more active. In September 2013, as anxiety about the Fed's tapering rose to a crescendo, India negotiated an increase in its existing swap line arrangement with Japan from $10 billion to $50 billion. In December, Japan doubled the swap line facilities it offered to Indonesia and the Philippines, and announced that it would be looking to negotiate similar bargains with Singapore, Thailand, and Malaysia. Japan's enormous reserve holdings of dollar assets, second only to those of China's, gave it the means to offer such facilities. And in the event of a crisis, the Bank of Japan could always draw on the Fed. Thus, dollar liquidity would percolate out through the entire system. As in 2008 to 2009, in 2013, the public bluster about the need for a new monetary order and a de-Americanized world distracted from the reality that a powerful new network of liquidity provision was being rolled out across the world economy. The swap line story stayed buried on the interior pages of the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal. There was no fanfare, no new Bretton Woods conference. There was also no congressional or parliamentary approval. These were administrative measures. But they were also far more than that. 5 years on from the crisis, while markets remained unsettled and the American political system was racked by dissension, the global dollar system was being given a new and unprecedentedly expansive foundation. About the technical efficacy of the swap lines there was little doubt. Their political legitimacy was a different matter. And in the autumn of 2013, one couldn't help thinking of another of America's technical systems of power that had been revealed earlier that year. The NSA's electronic surveillance network. The network that Edward Snowden exposed in early June also centered on U.S. power and technological capacity. It, too, was no American monolith. Like the Fed, the NSA worked through local agencies. It, too, promised to provide a blanket of security for the United States and its allies. Of course, spying and exchanging currencies were not the same things. But they did have in common that their functional power and administrative efficacy were not matched by anything resembling public political authorization. They were testimony at one and the same time to the continuing significance of U.S. global power and the difficulty in justifying that power in public, either in the United States or in the countries whose governments and business interests were enrolled in America's network. Chapter 21. F. The EU. The Ukraine Crisis. Before 2008, the driver of crisis was expected to be the balance of financial terror between the United States and China. A huge unwinding of the global disequilibrium centered on China and America, and driven by profound domestic imbalances in each of them, would, it was feared, rock American power to its foundations. In 2008, the expansion of the EU and NATO, in the face of Russian opposition, had added another dimension of risk. Georgia and Russia had clashed, and Moscow had approached Beijing to mount a joint attack on America's fragile finances. Beijing had held back. There was no great dollar sell-off. The geo-economic course of the crisis took an unexpected and innovative direction. The Fed's liquidity swap lines stabilized the dollar-based financial system. In November 2008, the upgrading of the G20 had added a global leadership forum, and this had been important in legitimizing the dramatic expansion of IMF resources in 2009. This backstopped the IMF's urgent engagement in Eastern Europe. A year later, remarkably, the IMF would find itself committing hundreds of billions of dollars to rescuing the Eurozone. At the same time, the United States was aggressively pushing a new system of regulation for global banking through the normally slow-moving Basel Committee. In 2008 and 2009, Washington kept ahead of the geo-economic challenges unleashed by the crisis. Could it stay on pace? In May 2010, the Obama administration and the IMF were crucial to forcing the Europeans toward the first fix for the Eurozone. But then things began to get sticky. November 2010 was a turning point. The Democrats lost control of Congress. The recovery was so lame and the fiscal impasse so threatening that the Fed launched its cautious second wave of QE to be met with violent opposition at the G20 meeting in Seoul. But carping at the G20 was one thing. When it came to chaperoning the Europeans through the near disaster of 2011 and 2012, it was obvious that only the Obama administration could serve as a counterbalance to Germany. Obama was right. At least as far as Europe was concerned, the United States as an inside-outside arbiter was indispensable. But with the stabilization of Europe and the beginning of the second Obama administration, the questions of the Bush era returned. Should Washington maintain its massive global footprint? Could it safely withdraw? Would either internal constraints or external pressures allow this to be decided as a matter of deliberate choice? Would it be an orderly retreat, leaving a legacy of stability, or would it be a disorderly rout? Impelled as she was by the energy and sense of mission that descended from the 1990s, as well as her own ambitions for the presidency, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, was in the proactive camp. In the autumn of 2011, as it finalized the pullout from Iraq, Clinton's State Department tried to get back on the front foot. The Pivot to Asia was its new initiative. In military terms, this consisted of the redeployment of a carrier battle group to the Pacific. In economic terms, it axed on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. As Europe slid deeper into crisis in 2011, the US Treasury and Trade Representative pressured Canada and Mexico to join them in a wide-ranging trade and investment treaty with the leading economies of Asia, not including China. The aim was not to face China down, let alone to stop its economic growth. Everyone had too much to gain. The aim was to establish a bloc strong enough to offer a counterweight to China's rising strength. It was, as one of Hillary Clinton's indiscreet correspondents dubbed it, a de facto China containment alliance. Back to 1947, containment was the glue that had held together the powerful alliance network that the United States had constructed in Western Europe and East Asia. That alliance system massively extended America's reach. It was the grounds on which committed liberal internationalists defended the idea that America remained a hegemonic force. But it also exposed the United States to risk. Containment could be given different shadings, and those depended as much on America's allies as on any decision in Washington. The allies had their own politics and their own economic problems. Their enrollment in America's sphere, whether through finance, trade, or security policy, excited those interests further. From Beijing's point of view, America's Asian pivot took on a distinctly darker coloration with the election in December 2012 of the nationalist politician Shinzo Abe as the Japanese prime minister. Abe was deeply concerned about China's power. He was unabashed in his support for a stronger and more independent Japanese military. And he was also willing to override domestic economic interests for the sake of strategic cooperation with the United States. He was even willing to sacrifice Japan's rice farmers to make his country into a key pillar of TPP. If he was willing to do that, what else might he do? By 2014, there was talk of a war scare between Japan and China. Corralling South Korea, Australia, Japan, and Vietnam into the American geo-economic alliance system was, if anything, too easy. Their interest in containing China was obvious. The risk was that America's new engagement with Asia would harden positions and trigger regional clashes which were not in America's interests. That was not the case with the Europeans. But by the same token, their enrollment in the project of containing China was less reliable. The EU was deeply interested in Chinese trade and investment. Germany wanted to sell cars and engineering equipment. When they tired of the endless battles in the Eurozone, Berlin's policy elite liked to fantasize about a global future in partnership with Beijing. The City of London was angling for a special position in the internationalization of the RMB. Nor were the Americans the only ones pursuing an expansive geo-economic strategy. In October 2013, on his way to the APEC meeting in Bali, President Xi Jinping announced China's new investment bank proposal. It was a bold, multilateral initiative to upgrade Asia's infrastructure. Everyone was invited to join. It was a leaf straight out of America's own playbook, and Washington did not like it. The Obama administration let it be known that it did not approve the Chinese initiative, and South Korea, Japan, and Australia promptly fell into line. But the UK, which was doing everything possible to court Chinese business, took up the offer from Beijing to become a founding member of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Washington was furious. London had made its decision, a State Department official let it be known, without prior consultation. America did not approve the trend toward constant accommodation of China, which is not the best way to engage a rising power. But London wasn't listening, nor were the other Europeans who promptly signed up too. Asked about US opposition, one British official commented wryly that it must be difficult for the Obama administration to conduct international economic policy under current political conditions. If Congress wouldn't approve a tiny increase in China's IMF quota, what was to be expected on trade and investment? They couldn't have got congressional approval to join the AIIB, even if they wanted to. Indeed, thanks to the congressional shutdown, Obama was prevented from attending APEC's Bali meeting. America's domestic political problems were spilling over into the conduct of global strategy, and the world was not going to wait. Given the stresses that the United States was evidently under, it might have made sense to invert Kissinger's famous move in the 1970s and to seek a closer relationship with Russia as part of the effort to contain China. It is unclear whether Washington was ever willing to take Russia seriously as a strategic partner at the level even of Japan or Saudi Arabia. In 2009, the Obama administration did set out to build better relations. With Medvedev as president, the reset seemed promising. To promote his modernizing agenda, Medvedev was invited to tour Silicon Valley in the company of Governor Schwarzenegger. Russian business eagerly seized the opportunities offered by cheap dollar funding. In 2011, Medvedev was compliant over NATO's intervention in Libya, so much so that it provoked a counter-reaction in Moscow. Putin, biding his time in the number two position as prime minister, watching footage of Gaddafi's horrible fate, became morbidly preoccupied. The same Western powers that had shamelessly courted the Libyan dictator had turned on him, bombing his military and delivering him to the vengeful mob. One would be a fool to trust them. Medvedev's appeasement would only invite further aggression. Putin would have to take back control. This decision was only confirmed when Moscow erupted in protests over the winter of 2011-2012 following rigged parliamentary elections. Clinton barely disguised her enthusiasm for regime change. Instead of reset and détente, Putin returned to the presidency in 2012 with new determination. In opposition to the liberalism of the Obama administration, the Kremlin donned the garb of conservative cultural nationalism, gay rights, feminist pop provocateurs, and the Greek yogurt rations for America's Olympic athletes all got sucked into a postmodern rerun of the Cold War. It was certainly not the balancing against China that one might have expected. But nor was it the Americans who brought about the open crisis in relations between Russia and the West. It was America's most important ally, the Europeans. The EU would later claim that it sleepwalked into the Ukraine crisis. This was part of a piece with its guileless insistence that the EU does not do geopolitics. That perhaps described the naivete of some officials in Brussels, but it never really rang true. It would be fairer to say that European nation-states did not agree on the geopolitics they were pursuing by way of the EU. France and Berlin loved the détente with Moscow. Poland and Sweden did not. With active support from NATO, the new Europeans championed the EU's eastern partnership with the post-Soviet states. It was no secret in Warsaw or Riga that this, like TPP, was a de facto containment policy. As far as Poland was concerned, the priority was clear. In the words of President Bronislaw Komorowski, "Never again do we want to have a common border with Russia." The instruments of the EU's Eastern Partnership were EU association agreements. These were complex documents harmonizing regulations, liberalizing trade and the movement of workers. The agreement with Ukraine, initialed in 2012, was hailed as the most extensive agreement ever completed with a non-EU member. It ran to 1,200 pages of technical detail, subdivided into the 28 separate subsections of the acquis communautaire. Trade and business regulations were the main focus of the association agreements, but they were not innocent with regard to security policy. Article 4 of the Ukraine Association Agreement called for political dialogue in all areas of mutual interest. This will promote gradual convergence on foreign and security matters with the aim of Ukraine's ever deeper involvement in the European security area. Article 7 provided for EU-Ukrainian convergence in foreign affairs, security and defence. Under Article 10 on conflict prevention, crisis management and military technological cooperation, Ukraine and the EU were to explore the potential of military and technological cooperation. Ukraine and the European Defence Agency, EDA, will establish close contacts to discuss military capability improvement, including technological issues. By 2013, talks with Ukraine were the most advanced, but the EU's Eastern Partnership negotiations proceeded on a broad front. At a summit conference in Vilnius on November 29th to 30th, 2013, Brussels was hoping not only to sign the association agreement with Ukraine, but to initial agreements with Moldova, Georgia, and Armenia. Brussels had also been negotiating with Belarus. After incorporating the Baltics and the East European Warsaw Pact in the early 2000s, Brussels was now seeking to deepen and transform its relations with the rest of what had once been the Western Soviet Union. It was undeniably a major shift in international relations, and it was all the more significant for the fact that it clashed directly with Russia's ambitions for the region. Since 2011, Russia had been developing its Eurasian Customs Union into a more comprehensive Eurasian Economic Union. It was clearly intended as an alternative to the EU's Eastern Partnership. The details of its agreements were far less onerous than those demanded by the EU. But they meant entering into a lopsided relationship with Russia, and the customs union included setting a common external tariff. This was incompatible with the EU association agreement. With goodwill, a compromise between the EU's association agreements and the Eurasian Customs Union could no doubt have been worked out. But that was not the mood on either side. The technical and economic issues of harmonizing two different economic blocs were overlaid by geopolitical tension, whether Brussels acknowledged it or not. There was a choice to be made. Did the East European governments want to face West or East? Brussels let it be known that membership in Putin's Eurasian Union was incompatible with an EU association agreement. Commission President Barroso refused the Kremlin's invitation for negotiations between the two blocs. Brussels did not accept their equivalence. In the absence of any agreement between the two, Moscow informed Ukraine and Armenia that if they proceeded with the EU, they should expect sanctions from Russia. Signing an association agreement would be a suicidal step. Under the anodyne labels of association, cooperation, and convergence, a heavy geopolitical weight was being imposed on a fragile region under considerable economic and political stress. Across the post-Soviet world, the economic and political recovery from the shock of 2008 was uneven. On the northern flank, the Baltics continued on their course toward the west. Estonia joined the euro on January 1, 2011. Latvia, the pivotal crisis country of 2009, adopted the common currency on January 1, 2014, followed a year later by Lithuania. The rest of Eastern Europe was supposed, under the terms of their 2004 accession, to join the euro in due course too. But progress in that direction was set back severely by the eurozone crisis. Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski announced in December 2011 that he looked forward to Poland joining the euro by 2016, but only if the currency union was reformed and it was clearly in Poland's national interest to do so. Donald Tusk, as Prime Minister, promised to launch a national debate on euro membership, but the main opposition, the nationalist Law and Justice Party, promptly responded by denouncing any further steps toward European integration as subordination to Germany. In Poland, the nationalists were in opposition. In Hungary, they were the government. In the April 2010 election, the ruling Socialist Party paid the price for its corrupt and duplicitous handling of economic policy and the financial disaster of 2008, promising to protect the Hungarian nation and Hungarian pensioners from the depredations of the IMF. A coalition headed by the nationalist Fidesz Party and the Christian Democrats won 53% of the vote. Even more startlingly, the Jobbik movement, which toyed openly with neo-fascism, scored 17%, bringing the total nationalist vote to 70%. Among Fidesz's heresies was its refusal to separate the questions of political sovereignty and financial dependence. Ignoring protests from the IMF and the EU, it justified its taxes on foreign banks and a raid on private pension funds in terms of harsh historical necessity. Since freeing itself from the Soviet yoke, over the past 20 years, Hungary had to bitterly experience the validity and truth of the old wisdom that a nation can be subjugated in two ways, with the sword or with debt. As Greece was submitting itself to the Troika in April 2010, a defiant Prime Minister Orbán told a news conference, "In my view, neither the IMF nor the EU's financial bodies are our bosses. We are not subordinate to them. Hungary would negotiate, but it would not accept diktats. Orbán's aggressive nationalism and Fidesz's campaign to curtail civil liberties and political pluralism reversed the liberalization of Hungarian political culture since the end of communism. But, after their own fashion, Orbán's aggressive revenue-raising measures and nationalist austerity worked. Inflation came down to below 2%. In December 2011, an agreement was reached with the foreign banks on a deal to share the cost of restructuring household debts. With Hungary having met the 3% budget deficit target, the EU lifted the humiliating excess deficit procedures under which the country had laboured since its accession to the Union. In the context of the emerging market boom, foreign lenders looked leniently on Orbán's nationalist experiment. With ample funding, in the summer of 2013, Hungary paid off the IMF and asked the fund to shut its office in Budapest. To further bolster his position, in early 2013, Orbán embarked on a new détente with Moscow. An alliance with Russia was by no means an obvious choice for a Hungarian nationalist, but Orbán was given a warm welcome in the Kremlin. Putin cheered his experiment in illiberal democracy and offered material assistance in the form of nuclear reactor technology and subsidized gas supplies, which were popular with Fidesz voters. Securely embedded in both the EU and NATO, Hungary could afford to take the risk of balancing between East and West. A tiny candidate country for an EU association agreement like Armenia, menaced by sanctions from Russia, was not in the same position. Faced with a clear threat from Moscow, in September 2013, Yerevan pulled back. It declared its intention of joining Putin's Eurasian Customs Union, prompting Brussels to close the door on the association agreement. This setback for the EU's eastern policy made Ukraine all the more important. Given its size and geopolitical significance, it was Kiev's posture that would decide the balance of influence in the region. The EU was convinced of its own legitimacy. It offered the rule of law and prosperity. Its promise was the future. Ignoring the evident risks that Ukraine was too weak economically, too fragile politically, and too exposed in geopolitical terms to stand the pressure generated between Russia and the West, Brussels pushed forward. That Ukraine needed a change was undeniable. Even after the losses of 2008 to 2009 were made good, according to official figures, average incomes in 2013 were barely higher than in 1989. Unlike its neighbours to the west, the post-communist transition in Ukraine had produced a generation of stagnation. While a tiny minority grew fabulously rich, the standard of living for the least well-off was kept at a tolerable level only by a system of pensions and energy subsidies that consumed 17% of GDP. In 2008, the IMF had provided emergency assistance, but the programme came with demands for changes in taxes and benefits that made it impossible for a government to sustain legitimacy. By the time of the February 2010 election, much of the population was deeply disillusioned. Ukraine was falling further and further behind not only its Western neighbours, but Putin's Russia too. President Yushchenko effectively withdrew from the electoral race, leaving Prime Minister Tymoshenko to go head-to-head with Yanukovych, whose fraudulent